The Fall, Part 2, the 12th talk in a series entitled Biblical Philosophy, the Message and Worldview of the Bible, was presented by Jack Crabtree on February 19, 2012, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. The notes mentioned in this talk are in handout number 8 in this series.
We'll continue our series on a critique of what I've called the Ordinary Christian's Creed in a series called Biblical Philosophy, the Worldview and Message, or the Message and Worldview of the Bible. Last week, we talked about several elements of that creed that all revolve around the nature and the notion of the fall, and that's what we're going to focus on a little bit. We started that last week. We'll continue that here. The obvious problem or potential objection to what I was saying last week and what I said last week is that I think the traditional view of the fall, which, by the way, is never actually taught in the Bible. The word doesn't occur in the Bible. That's a theological concept that we bring to our reading of the Bible. That the traditional concept of the fall, I think, is not a biblical notion at all. And what I mean by the traditional concept of the fall is that Adam and Eve had a certain amount of autonomy. God created the first man and woman to have the freedom from independence from God, to be able to make a choice as to what it is that they were going to do. Were they going to pursue a path that would lead to goodness, or were they going to pursue a path that would lead to evil? They made a free choice, autonomous choice, to choose to disobey God, and in choosing to disobey God, they were actually choosing to become evil. And we'll talk a little bit more about this later, but they're actually making a choice that would render their nature evil. And that's what we need to talk about. Because it made their nature evil, they themselves forfeited the ultimate reward that God had promised or had intended anyway for those people who remained obedient to him. They forfeited that. And we, in the creed, it argued that that ultimate destiny was a eternal love relationship with their creator. They forfeited that and instead earned them themselves a destiny in hell. Well, that's the doctrine that I'm critiquing. And what I argued is that that's not what the Bible teaches, and that in fact, what makes the most sense out of what the Bible teaches is that reality, created reality that we're a part of, is this narrative, a tragic narrative, but a narrative. It's a narrative where God created a race of rebels. So Adam and Eve, as they came into the garden, were already rebels against God. And what the test in the garden did is it revealed and manifest who they were. It didn't make them rebels. It revealed the fact that they were already rebels. Therefore, they were already creatures who were subject to God's condemnation. And the story then that God is beginning there in the garden is a story of mercy and redemption. It's intended to be a narrative that gets played out over the course of history where God reaches down into a race of creatures who are worthy of condemnation, destruction, and death because of the condition of their heart and their orientation toward God. Although they deserve destruction and death, God, in his profound compassion and mercy, reaches down, plucks some of us out of what Paul calls the kingdom of darkness, and transfers us to the kingdom of his beloved Son. So he takes us out of this world that is on its way to destruction, and instead gives us a place and a standing and an inheritance in the future kingdom of God where Jesus will rule as his Son. That, I think, is the biblical picture. There's no fall there. There's no fall from perfection to imperfection. It begins in imperfection with the ultimate goal being one day to be, if you want to call it that, perfection for some. Now, that leaves open the question, well, what's going on exactly in Genesis then? So let me make a few comments about that before we go any further. What is going on in Genesis? Well, I would argue that Genesis, in whatever literary form it is, I have no reason to take it in any other way than a historical account of a historical event that actually happened. The trees in that garden had real bark that you could get slivers off of if you rubbed your hands on them. There were a number of trees in the garden. My reading of the text is that all the trees were basically the same kind of tree. So, I mean, they may have been varieties, but the point is they all had real edible fruit on them. So if the tree, one of them got designated by God, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Another of them got designated by God, the tree of life. The designation, I think, did not distinguish the kind of thing that it was, but only what it symbolized, only what it represented. So the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, let's say it's an apricot tree, was right next to another apricot tree sitting right next to it. And God said, of this apricot tree sitting next to the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, you can freely eat. But the apricots on the tree designated the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, I don't want you to eat from that. So it wasn't that the tree of the knowledge of good and evil had a magical fruit with magical juice in it. I don't think that's how we're to read the account. It wasn't that the chemicals in that fruit were going to do something to make them this perfect creature that God had made imperfect somehow. No, it was a normal tree. So when the tempter tempts Eve, the account says that Eve saw that the fruit was good to eat, that it appealed to the eyes, that it was good to eat, and that it was good to make her wise. How did she know it was good to eat? I think because she could look there and say, well, that fruit is just like that fruit, and I've been eating that for months, and I haven't got sick yet. Crosby, Stills, and Nash there. And hasn't got sick yet. So she knows that it's good to eat. Therein lies the subtlety of the temptation. Surely God has not prevented me from eating this because there's a problem with it. She saw that it was good to make her wise. I think what's going on there is Eve is being seduced by the tempter into taking the perspective, oh, I see. God does not want me to merely listen to his voice and obey his voice. He wants me to grow up. He wants me to become mature. He wants me to become wise. He wants me to decide for myself what I will eat and what I won't eat. And I can see that with my own eyes that tree is good to eat. I must launch myself. I must branch out, become a wise creature who stops listening merely to the voice of God and decides for myself. Now, that's what God said would happen, is that in the day that you eat of it, you will become like me, God, in knowing good and evil. That doesn't mean that the magical juices in the fruit are going to inject you with divine supernatural wisdom. What that means is, in the day that you eat from that, you will have made the determination that you can choose what is good and what is evil from your own standpoint. That's how God decides what's good and evil, is from his own standpoint. If I as a creature decide what's good and evil from my own standpoint, I'm making myself out to be as God. The tempter tried to make that sound like a good thing. God recognizes that as a bad thing. But the tempter was trying to seduce Eve into taking the perspective, that's a good thing, and surely God would want that of you. Surely God would want you to be so wise that you can decide what's good and what's evil from your own standpoint. So she ate, and in eating it, what was she doing? She was showing what she was made of. She was a creature who was ready and willing to rebel against her creator, to act right in the face of the direct commandment of God to not do something. She was going to do it anyway. Adam followed suit, and we see that every last one of us in this race of humanity, we are what Adam and Eve were. They were the prototypes. God created us to be just like them. And what are we? We are rebels against God who, due to our rebellion, are worthy to be destroyed by God. What was always striking to me about Genesis is, it, as compared to the traditional view, you don't have any little phrase, any little word, any little whisper anywhere in Genesis 1. And Eve ate of the fruit, and in the distance you heard a big bang. Because if in fact the traditional view is right, the universe had to go from a universe made to live, to exist and endure forever, in other words, what a physicist would call an anentropic universe, that is a universe that is not based on entropy, the second law of thermodynamics, or built into the very physics of the universe is deteriorating, falling apart, unraveling, that if it was made forever, it would have to be an anentropic universe. And so Eve's biting that fruit, eating of that fruit, changed the laws of physics from an anentropic universe to an entropic universe, and there wasn't even a sound. I mean, that there's no indication that this cataclysmic thing happened that was the total transformation of all the laws of physics. I just think that's unthinkable. And therefore, it makes me think that the laws of physics were not rewritten when she ate the fruit. It was just a straight line from the garden to us. We are what they were what we are, and they always were that from the very moment that they were created. And what they were doing in the garden was simply revealing and manifest who all of us are, what kind of beings we are. Okay, let me go a little bit further before I open it up for any discussion or questions. Point C on the outline, if you're following the outline. Traditionally, the traditional view talks about cosmic justice or divine justice being built into the fabric of the cosmos. And that what happened when Adam and Eve fell, when we see that they are subject to condemnation, what happened at that moment is they started in process something that not even God could fix. Or at least God couldn't fix it by just being merciful. What he had to do is actually intervene in the created order now and do some kind of workaround within the mechanics, the mechanisms of the cosmic order. It's the only way he could save us. I think that's the model. And just to give you a picture of the two, imagine that I'm somewhere near Niagara Falls, and I'm sitting in a boat or on a bridge or a dock or something, and I say to my three-year-old child, "Now don't jump in the river." And my child, being like me, jumps in the river. Well, the current taking them to their destruction, it doesn't do any good for me to stand on the bridge and say, "I forgive you, I forgive you. I don't want you to be destroyed. I forgive you." My mercy is irrelevant at that point, because even though it may be true that I forgive my child for disobeying me, there are consequences to their disobedience. They are being swept down the river to their destruction now, and the only way I can save them is to do something to snatch them out of that current. That's the only way I can save them. That's the traditional view. Is that God set up this situation that was dangerous. It was a very dangerous situation. And Adam and Eve, in their disobedience, they jumped in the river. They set the principles of, or they violated the principles of justice in the universe in such a way that they set the what in motion? What is it? Oh, there you go. Set the wheel in motion that was going to take them directly and inevitably to their destruction. Unless somehow God could jump into the machinery of the cosmos and do the workaround that was going to extricate them from where that justice was taking them. And we'll talk more about that later, but that's the story of Jesus coming, dying on the cross. That was him jumping into the river and taking us by the scruff of the neck and taking us out of the current. But he had to do that. He couldn't fix it by just being merciful. Now, a contrasting picture. I've just painted the wall of my living room, and my three-year-old is sitting there with a permanent marker. And I say, don't draw a picture on this wall with that permanent marker. And I leave the room, and I come back, and there's a picture on the wall from the permanent marker. Now, rightly, that child may suffer my wrath, may have to face and be confronted by my wrath. But there's one simple solution that's going to keep them from experiencing my wrath. Simple, straightforward forgiveness. Simple, straightforward mercy on my part. And as we will get to the atonement, I'm going to argue that that's the biblical picture. God is not snatching us out of the stream in the Niagara River that's taking us to our destruction. God is simply saying to us, okay, I'm not going to give you what you deserve. I'm just going to let my wrath go unsatisfied here. I don't need to vent my wrath. You're forgiven. So that's another aspect to the traditional view of the fall, I think, that I'm taking issue with. Next point, D. I will argue that the traditional doctrine of hell as the penalty for sin, that too is not a biblical doctrine. And what I mean by hell, I don't mean that there's no place of punishment. So if you just think of hell as a place of punishment, no, I think that is at least implicit in the biblical teaching. But the traditional concept of hell is a place of everlasting torment. Everlasting torment, eternal, non-ending torment. That's not the clear and incontrovertible teaching of the Bible, and in fact, I would argue, I think it is so much in conflict with certain biblical assertions and teaching that it can't possibly be right. It seems to be a fiction that got introduced into Christianity. I don't know from where. I haven't done the reading or research on that to have any clear idea. Some have suggested that it comes from Islam. I don't know if that's true. But it seems to be a fictional picture that got introduced into Christianity and has stayed behind. And so it just seems commonplace to us. I mean, we can't imagine thinking about the biblical worldview without thinking in terms of heaven and hell. And hell is a fixture in our worldview. Romans 5, it seems to me, makes hell impossible in that sense. Let me read from my translation here. Paul is comparing and contrasting who we are and where we stand due to Adam and in relationship to Adam with who we are and where we stand in relation to Christ. He says, but it is not the case that as the transgression, so also the gift. For if by the transgression of the one man, there he's talking about Adam, if by the transgression of the one man the many died, much more certainly did the grace of God and the gift by the grace of the one man, Jesus the Messiah, prevail with respect to the many. Furthermore, the gift is not like that which arises through the one who sinned. On the one hand, judgment leading to furthermore, the gift is not like that which arises through the one who sinned, for on the one hand, judgment leading to condemnation results from one transgression. But on the other hand, the free gift is in response to many transgressions, which would lead to a just penalty. So if by the transgression of the one, death reigned through that one, much more certainly those who are receiving the prevailing reality of grace, that is the gift of dikaiosune, forgiveness, pardon, these will reign in life through the one, Jesus, the Messiah. Okay, there's a key sentence in there. He says, for on the one hand, judgment leading to condemnation results from one transgression, but on the other hand, the gift of grace is in response to many transgressions that would lead to a just penalty. Now, if we were to unpack that, my contention would be the point that Paul is making is the mercy of God is completely asymmetrical with the justice of God. God's justice is measured, fair, right, just, and good. God's mercy is abundant and ridiculous. It is ridiculously abundant. Any one of my transgressions will reveal the fact that I deserve destruction. The mercy of God looks at myriads of transgressions and forgives them all. It doesn't forgive half of them and say, you still owe me for the other half. It forgives every manifestation, every element of my of the unrighteousness and ungodliness that's worthy of my condemnation. That's how disproportionate they are. But in order for Paul's point to stand, notice that hell would make a liar out of Paul. Because if God's justice is everlasting, is unending, is infinite, if you will, if God's punishment for sins is that severe, it's all out of proportion to who we are and what we've done. I'm a finite creature. There's only so much time to sin so much in this life. There's only so much evil that I can manifest in my life. When you've finished punishing me for that, then what? You keep doing it? You keep tormenting me forever and ever and ever, even beyond what's just, beyond what's proportional, beyond what's fair? That makes no sense. And yet that's the very point that Paul is basing his argument on. The gift is not like the transgression. The gift is abundant and infinite and unending. It's deep and without limits. God's justice knows limits. God will not be wrathful and condemning beyond what is right, beyond what is good. Often in Calvinistic circles, they like to make an analogy between Adam and Jesus, that in Adam we are all sinners, just as in Christ we are all righteous with the righteousness of Christ. And if you complain that, well, it's not right for me to condemn for Adam, they say, well, it's not right and fair that you be made righteous in Christ, so shut up. Or something more theologically. The problem is they're making a huge moral mistake there. To be unfair in the direction of goodness is not unrighteous. It just shows how profound your goodness is. To be unfair in the direction of harm and destruction is evil. That is not good, that's evil. So to think in terms of the doctrine of hell, the doctrine of hell is an evil doctrine, or at least, let me put it this way, the doctrine of hell makes God out to be evil. He would have to be evil to send people to eternal torment for the ungodliness in their lives. God is just, so whatever he dishes out is going to be just and right in proportion to what they deserve. God's mercy, God's goodness, God's blessing, that's not going to be in proportion to what we do. It's going to be completely all out of proportion. But that's not a problem. If God is unfair in giving us life when we don't deserve it. So be it. But it's a good God who blesses when people don't deserve it. Unjust blessing is a good thing. Unjust condemnation is an evil thing. I mean, you see the difference, the lack of symmetry there? So to argue that we need the symmetry, I think, is hugely mistaken. No, we don't want the symmetry. We want God to be very asymmetrical. We want him to be measured and fair and just when it comes to condemnation. We want him to be completely unjust when it comes to blessing. Okay, that at least I think is exactly Paul's point that he's making in Romans 5. So what does the Bible teach? That's a little harder to pin down. It seems to be, to me, that you find two things being stated in the scriptures. The end of the evil, the unforgiven, those people who are not going to receive the blessing of eternal life. What is their end? On the one hand, it seems to be destruction. But on the other hand, clearly, there are statements to the effect that they will receive for what they have done in their bodies. They will be recompensed, paid back for what they have done in the body. So if I were to have to place a bet at this point, I think I would bet that the truth is that those things are true sequentially. That if we are not pardoned at the judgment seat, then we will indeed be punished. As Paul puts it in Romans 2, there will be tribulation and distress for every soul of man who does evil. There's going to be some period of tribulation and distress that is in store for us if we are not pardoned, because that's what we deserve. We deserve to be condemned and punished for our evil. But that tribulation and distress, that time of punishment, is not eternal for the reasons I've just been arguing. It will come to an end, at which point it would appear that the ultimate destiny of the sinner is the lake of fire, along with everything else. Now, the lake of fire is not a picture of eternal torment. We're not like the burning bush. We burn forever and are not consumed. That's not what the lake of fire is all about. Fire incinerates. Fire destroys. Fire reduces to ashes, that is, to nothing. Notice that what's put in the lake of fire in Revelation are abstractions. Hades is put in the lake of fire. Hades is death. Death is not being tormented forever. Death is being incinerated. It's being destroyed so that death is no more. Satan and his angels are thrown into the lake of fire. I think what that means is they are going to be made gone. They're not going to exist any longer. They're going to be annihilated. So I think the ultimate end of those who don't receive pardon after they are justly and duly punished for the sins that they have done in the body is going to be their destruction, their annihilation. That seems to be the best way to put together the evidence. I haven't done enough work on that, so I'm ready to have my mind changed, but that's where I land today. Okay, let me finish this before I open it up for your questions. Next point, the ordinary Christian's creed tends to reflect a version of the traditional doctrine of original sin. And I would argue that it's based on a faulty view of original sin. There are two versions of the doctrine of original sin. One is that Adam became evil, so he messed with his genes, basically, and his gene, he developed an evil gene, a sin gene, and then from then on, Adam passed down the sin gene to his children. If it hadn't been for that sin gene being introduced, he could have passed down perfection to his children, but that magic juice in the fruit introduced a sin gene, and he passed that sin gene down to his offspring. Obviously that's a caricature, but that's the basic fundamental notion of one version of original sin. I should have done these in the other order, but the other version of original sin is that Adam himself incurred guilt for his sin, and that it's that guilt that gets passed on down to his offspring. It's called federal headship theory. That is, that God so organized humanity that he kind of appointed Adam to be the one who is going to make a decision that the whole rest of the human race was going to have to suffer the consequences of. So Adam, when he sinned, he incurred guilt, and that guilt then gets passed on to the whole human race after him. We are blamed for what Adam did. When this view of original sin is in play, that the Sunday school teacher says, you know, in objection, but what if I lived a perfect life? Would I still have to be condemned because of what Adam did? And the answer is yes. Even if you lived a perfect life, even if you had no sins of your own, nonetheless, you were born into this world already condemned because of a choice that Adam did. Let me talk about that one first, and then we'll come back to the other version. That, I think, is philosophically incoherent. It makes no sense for me to be morally blameworthy for something that someone else did, even if I am their child. In fact, it's in violation of a law in Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy says, "You shall not put to death a son for the sins of his father, neither shall you put to death a father for the sins of his son." Well, that's in the law. You know, the Mosaic law itself says that. So that's clearly God's sense of justice, and it's our commonsensical concept of justice, I think, that it's the perpetrator who has guilt and therefore ought to be recompensed for their guilt for anything that they do. It's the perpetrator. And no one else can be recompensed for a transgression that I have done, and that be in any sense just. So that concept of original sin, it seems to me, is just philosophically and morally incoherent. The other one is acknowledging that I would be blamed for my own transgressions, but why do I transgress in the way that I do? Because I got the sin gene from my parents, who got it from their parents, who ultimately got it from Adam and Eve. That's fine if it makes any sense to have a sin gene. Or, to use the language that we're more comfortable with in Christian circles, a sin nature. If it makes any sense to think in terms of a sin nature. And my contention would be, if we're going to talk about a sin nature, that's a philosophical fiction. It may be useful, and I don't have any problem with us using it as a philosophical fiction to talk to each other, but we have to understand what we're doing. If by a sin nature we mean something metaphysically in me that causes me to do evil, that necessitates that whatever choice I make has to be an evil choice, that makes no sense. That too is philosophically incoherent. Why am I? Because the Bible clearly presents the perspective that I'm morally accountable for my transgressions. When I disobey God, I am blameworthy for my disobedience. I'm not blameworthy for my heart beating. I'm not blameworthy for anything that happens in my physical body that is done in the background by physics and chemistry and biology without my volition, without my willful choice. You can't blame me for that. Why do we not blame you for that? Because it's caused. It's necessitated. It doesn't reflect your freedom. It doesn't reflect what you and your freedom have willed to do. It's just physics and chemistry happening. Well, the whole concept of the sin nature often for Christians becomes something that just causes you to do evil things beyond your control, outside of your will, outside of your freedom. If it did, I wouldn't be accountable for it. That there's no sense in which the Bible ever thinks that anyone ever makes me do evil. Why do I evil? Because I chose it. Why do I evil? Because I freely disobeyed God, pursued evil, pursued perversion, pursued whatever thing out there that I shouldn't be pursuing that's evil. I pursued it. I embraced it. I chose it. I wanted it. I desired it. I took it. I did it. And it's because it's me in my freedom choosing it and embracing it that I can be held accountable for it and should be held accountable for it. Well, if that's right, then it's not like there's some sin nature in me that made me do it. I just did it. Okay? So the whole concept of a sin nature is philosophically incoherent. Therefore, we can't inherit that from Adam. There's nothing there to be inherited. Now, is there a concept of sin nature that makes sense? Yeah, kind of. Because notice, and Paul uses this language in Romans 5, he calls Adam a tupos of what was to come. And by what he calls tupos, I think we would call a prototype. Adam was the prototype of the humanity that was to follow from him. What Adam was created to be by God, I am created to be by God. What he is, I am. Well, going back to Adam, remember, I'm arguing that no one made Adam eat of that fruit. He did it freely. He did it out of his own human free will. But was it scripted? Absolutely. He was following the script of the author of his being and of the author of all reality. God was creating and authoring Adam's free will choices, just as God authors our free will choices as well. Our lives also are scripted in the same way. And what is it scripted that we be? Sinful rebels against God, just like the original prototype Adam. So if you want to talk about a sin nature, then what you need to talk about is God's concept of who he is creating when he creates me. He's creating me a sinner. But I am a sinner out of the free will choices that I'm making, not out of determined, necessitated choices. It's not my machinery that makes me sin. It's what I simply choose in my freedom that makes me sin. Okay, let's stop there and give you, I've gone long, so let me give you a chance to respond to this.
Hey.
Hi.
I want to talk about hell really, I don't know, probably not quickly. I think I know the answer to this question, but I think it's an important enough question to bring up. So I agree with you that when you come to the Bible, it's pretty hard to come up with the notion of hell that we've all kind of inherited without a lot of imagination. But your argument against it from Romans 5, that it would be, that it's not a good example of God as good with how out of proportion the judgment is with the sin. And maybe you could talk about how that is different from creating creatures who are sinners to be judged in the first place. Why that is not a example of...
Okay. Yeah, good question. Well, I think I mentioned this last week, so forgive me if I'm too repetitious here, but it is, I mean, oftentimes an objection to the perspective that I'm taking here is that, well, how fair is it for God to create some creatures and then script their lives so that they rebel against him and then punish him in the end? Well, the reason that seems unfair is because the way we're envisioning it is that I'm up here with God before there's anything at all. We're sitting in nothingness together and hanging out in nothingness together. And then God creates something, and then he sends me into that something with a role that I play, and he scripts what I do, determines what I do, and I do evil. Then when I die, I leave that world, and I come back up to be with God, and then God slaps me around a little bit and says, and I go, what are you doing that for? Well, it's because of what you did down there. Well, yeah, that would be ridiculous. You know, that would just be really silly and morally objectionable. But that's not what happens. I never was there with God in the nothingness, and I never will be there. God has created a reality, and he's put me in it, and that reality has a structure to it, has a logic to it, has a rationality to it, has a morality to it, and he created me in that structure to be a bad guy in that structure. You know, I'm not a good guy, I'm a bad guy, and I deserve condemnation for who I am. So, inside the story itself, toward the end chapters of that story, God punishes me inside the story, not outside the story, if you're following me. So is that fair? Well, yeah, because that's what you do inside this story to bad guys, is they need to be punished. If you don't punish them, you're embodying a very, very different set of values than you set out to embody if you don't punish evil. So, okay, now I've lost your question. So that as opposed to...
Okay.
So hell is still inside the story, right? So the question is, inside the story, when you give them their recompense for the evil that they are and that they've done, is it going to be proportional or is it going to be not proportional? To be proportional means that the role that God is playing as judge he's playing the role of a just and righteous judge. If he were to give us everlasting torment inside the story, he would not be playing the role of a righteous and just judge, but of an evil judge.
Hi, Jack. I'm still struggling with the Jewish view of, is there a hell? And I'm looking at Psalm 139 when David said, where can I go from thy spirit? You know, I can, if I ascend into heaven, you're there. If I go down to Sheol, you're there. And the New American Standard calls that the netherworld. The one here calls it the depths. So do you have a comment on that, where their, you know, where their perspective on that might be?
Well, I wish I understood that better. I don't. Maybe somebody else here can help with that. But fundamentally, Sheol is the grave. It's what you are when you are dead and in the grave. That's being in Sheol. And I think it's pretty comparable to the Greek concept of Hades. Now, granted, in Greek thought, there's a whole mythology that is built up around Hades, and I suspect that a similar thing is built up around Sheol. But mostly those are just pictures and symbols. I think really basically the way the biblical authors use Sheol is simply death itself, the grave, the extinguishing of your vitality in this existence. That's Sheol. And that's what's thrown in the lake of fire in Revelation. It's called Hades. That's the Greek version of that. But that's what's thrown in the lake of fire. That the reality that we would ever see the vitality of my existence drained away and disappear, that's what goes away. We will never die in the kingdom of God because Hades has been destroyed. Death has been destroyed. The grave has been destroyed.
And you think that the Jewish mind understood that was pretty clear for them? I mean, it is there in the Old Testament, so... And you see John and Paul talking about it off and on in the New Testament.
I'm sorry, talking about what?
Well, just what you repeated, that, I mean, John had the vision that it was all thrown into the lake of fire in Revelations. So
it makes
it seem coherent that it was the Jewish idea of what would happen with death.
Oh, okay. Maybe I've misled you. No, Sheol is just the plain old ordinary concept of death that we face every day. You know, we die and we're buried. Going into that grave is Sheol or Hades. So the question then becomes, what happens beyond the grave? Anything? Are we just forever gone? Or is there something that happens beyond the grave? And I have not done this work. I know some of you have done more than I have, that even in the Old Testament, there are some pretty clear indications that the Jews in the Old Testament believed that there was a resurrection beyond the grave, and that there was life to be had beyond the grave. And that's what the New Testament makes very clear, that that's our destiny, is to be raised up as Jesus was, to be raised up to a whole new phase of existence beyond the grave. It's not just being resuscitated to this existence, but given a new, glorious, immortal existence beyond the grave.
Yeah, a while ago you were saying that Hades, hell, I mean, was of Islamic origin.
Yeah.
Well, to my understanding, the concept of hell comes from Greek polytheism, because in Hades there were obviously many levels of it, and the lowest one, I forget the exact name, but it was something like Tarnus or something, or Tartarus, but anyway, that was where the gods, Zeus in particular, imprisoned his personal enemies.
Okay.
Yeah, such as humans who had offended him, or his predecessors.
Okay. Yeah, certainly there'd be a lot of overlap between the mythology around Hades and hell. So, yeah, maybe that's its origin. I don't know. That's not something I've studied, so I can't really speak to that.
If you would, compare and contrast these two ideas. In the garden, God gave them a test site, right? I mean, it's kind of like, whoever comes through here is going to screw up, and they're going to discover, oh, I'm a screw up, right? But it seems to be a really trivial matter, mm-hmm. almost an administrative failure, because he didn't say.
You mean they didn't get the memo? Is
that what you're saying? Well, it would be one thing for God to say, don't you ever murder, because in that day you will die. Uh-huh. Or don't you ever lie, because in that day you will die. On the one hand, the proviso or the forbidding of eating of this tree, which almost sounds like the first holy object set aside for a certain purpose, but don't you eat of this tree? It seems rather arbitrary.
Yeah, I think it was totally arbitrary. Okay. Exactly.
So it was like, was he expressing the notion that whatever I tell you not to do, you'll eventually violate?
Yes. Yeah, I think the arbitrariness of it accentuates the gravity and the seriousness of the disobedience. I mean, what did they get out of that? You want an apricot? Eat it from that tree. What are they gaining? What is it that he's withheld from them? He hasn't withheld anything from them. But he's just said arbitrarily, but there's this tree here. See that label I've stuck on it, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil? Don't you be eaten from that tree. Okay? And then turn around and do it. I mean, it's precisely the arbitrariness of the command that I think accentuates how there wasn't anything to it except rebellion.
Because there wasn't any substance to it other than the command.
Right, that's right.
Okay.
Right.
And so when you get to the concept of proportional justice,
mm-hmm.
How do you measure way or proportion justice? Okay, I know.
Yeah, I've got a website. Got a formula on a website.
You're 5 miles over, you get a ticket. You're 15 miles over, you get a reckless driving ticket.
Right.
You're 30 miles over, you lose your license. I mean, that is right. Just a convention.
Yeah, fortunately, I'm not going to be deciding that, so I don't have to know how you measure that. But, you know, we do have a sense mm-hmm. of when something is out of proportion. You know, what in our Constitution is cruel and unusual punishment is forbidden. We know that you can go overboard, in punishing people for their offenses. I can't quantify it. I can't calculate it. I can't analyze it. But it is important, what I'm saying, and this is Paul's point, it is important to realize that whatever it is that God is going to do in the end as the just judge who punishes people, it's going to be fair and just and proportional. And I leave it up to him to decide what that looks like.
If something
is... Now, Adam and Eve and Logan would not be willing to leave that up to him, but I have a...
If something arbitrary and trivial, just to express a command, brings about such consequences, things like lying, stealing...
So is that what you're... Are you relating the two? You're asking what would be a proportional punishment to eating, to disobeying what is already an arbitrary command?
Well, no, I've always thought that God's thermometer, moral thermometer, was longer than ours and more sensitive than ours. And little things register a lot sooner on his than they do on ours.
Well, but I don't think you can measure the gravity of what Adam and Eve did by the action that they took. I think you have to measure it by the spiritual significance of what they did. That was huge. I mean, they were spitting in the face of the Creator is what they were doing. I mean, God could care less whether they ate the fruit. That wasn't, whatever punishment they get is not because God didn't want that apricot eaten. What the punishment comes from the incredible defiance where they spit in the face of their Creator in the midst of all the abundance that he had given them. Well, that's pretty serious, I think.
Is it the same thing that we see pictured in the myth of Lucifer where he says, I'm going to be as good as you?
Yeah.
I mean, that really sounds to me like what they're saying. Mm-hmm. It's like, I don't have to let you tell me what to do. Mm-hmm. I mean, who are you to tell me what's right and wrong? Mm-hmm. And the day I step into that role, I'm just as good as you.
Yeah, exactly. Even that desire is a serious evil. Yeah. Exactly.
I guess I've always had an assumption in the back of my mind about death, which can maybe be summed up by what people say at funerals, absent from the body, present with the Lord. But it sounds like what you've been saying lately and what I've heard you say before, the age to come, our future life, is still in sort of this reality. It's not where God is. It's
right
here or in another created reality. And we won't actually be like with God in the sense that people talk about a lot.
That's right. That's right.
Okay.
Yeah, that's just part of our traditional mythology, I think.
So I'm not going to like meet God in the way.
Not going to what?
Meet God.
No. See that in John 1, John says, no one has beheld God at any time. Now, I don't think he's just talking about, I don't think he means not yet. I think what he's talking about is it's fundamentally impossible for anyone to see God because God is transcendent and we are not. We are stuck here in this created realm. We can never leave this created realm and become transcendent with God such that we could be face to face and see him. That's an impossibility. And then he goes on to say, but the unique Son, he has translated him. So what we will be able to do is meet Jesus, who is God. He's the created image of God, not only when he came the first time, but now for all of eternity in the kingdom of God. The king of the kingdom that we're going to live in is God, embodied in human form. He is both our brother and our God. And we will be able to see and meet and have coffee with him if coffee is righteous.
Also, it sounds like from what you've been saying earlier, it's like God saved us from himself. I mean, that's what he's saving us from.
Yeah, from his own wrath. Exactly.
Right.
That's not right.
The popular view.
No.
Going back to the arbitrary tree, what about the tree of life? Is that arbitrary?
I think that was equally arbitrary. And I think it's not crystal clear from Genesis, but I think they had been eating of the tree of life because that wasn't forbidden of them. There's no nothing to make it clear that that has been proscribed. So I think they have been eating of the tree of life. They just have not been eating of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil because they were commanded not to. Then they did, and then what does he do? Sets these mean-looking cherubim around it with their swords to keep them from eating of the tree of life. Why? To symbolize. It's only a symbol. There's no magic juice in that fruit either that if you eat it will give you eternal life. I mean, sometimes people read the account like, oh, now God's got a problem. What if they sneak in and get that magic juice that makes them live forever, right? But again, I don't think that's not the right way to read it. That's an apricot tree too, with the sign, the tree of life on it. They've been eating it as a kind of symbolic, as a sacrament, if you will. I guess it's not a sacrament, as a ordinance, if you will. They've been eating of that tree to symbolize that God is going to grant them life. Well, when he cuts them off from eating of the tree of life, it symbolizes you are now doomed to death. God will not grant you life. So it's just basically a way of picturing very graphically the spiritual and moral reality of their destiny at that point.
If we set aside this interpretation that's based on your, I hesitate to call it an assumption because you've concluded that...
My well-considered conclusion.
You've concluded that it makes sense to consider that this is a literal historical story. But if we set that aside for a minute and imagine that instead of being literal historical, that it's figurative and symbolic, and that at some point some animal became human, and you know, we take maybe more of the evolutionary view, which would be, you know, the prevailing overall view of most people today. And then, so what is this account in the Bible? If it is figurative, does it change anything? If you can address that, or if that's too far off the subject, then I can talk to you privately.
Does it change anything? I mean, obviously it would change a little bit in just in terms of how you would picture the origin of everything, but would it change anything about how we are to look at our lives today? I don't think so. I don't see how it would. I'd have to think about it some more, but my off-the-cuff reaction is I don't think that it would change much. How is it that God made this Adam who is a rebel? He brought him out of the mud cell by cell and made him a animal, bestial-like being who had the potential to be an angel. But, okay. That wouldn't significantly change anything. I don't think that's right, just because evolution doesn't make any sense to me, not for biblical reasons, but for philosophical reasons, scientific reasons, it doesn't make any sense to me. And it does seem to me that the most natural way to read Jesus' comments is that he took the account of Adam and Eve as pretty straightforwardly, that they really were the first man and woman. So I'm inclined to just reject that picture. But philosophically, I don't think it would change anything.
Would you agree that at face value, at first glance, the story itself seems to be contrived? I mean, with all the appropriate sort of mythological apparatus?
Actually, I wouldn't.
Okay.
I would agree that because of the way it has always been told and the way we've been influenced to read it, it seems fanciful. But if I take the account of Adam and Eve and stack it against the Enuma Elish from the Babylonians, or stack it against the Gilgamesh epic, I mean, you want magic? I mean, how did Marduk win the world? He had all kinds of magical weapons and incantations, and I mean, there is magic flying everywhere in the Enuma Elish. What do you have in the garden? you have a magical tree that's probably not even magical, another magical tree that's probably not even magical, and a snake that's probably not even a snake. Beyond that, it's a pretty straightforward account of two people in a garden. So what's striking to me is how lacking in elements that are fanciful the Genesis account is, especially when you contrast it with the alternatives out there. The serpent is the most challenging thing, the talking serpent. But I have a theory about that, and I can't prove it. But I think the Hebrew word that gets translated serpent there probably in the origins of the language had a different meaning. And I don't exactly know what that is, but my guess is that Satan appeared to them in some kind of humanoid type form of some kind, either the form of a human being or whatever. He might have glowed in the dark. He might not have. I don't know what form he took, but whatever form he took, this word applied to the form he took. But I think he appeared in a form where talking and reasoning would make sense, which is not a serpent. I mean, whoever this is, it would make sense that this person would be talking to you. Now, notice then what happens in the curse. What happens in the curse is you will lick the dust of the earth. You will crawl on your belly and lick the dust of the earth. Well, what that means, of course, is you will be humiliated, basically. You're going to be flat down on your face in front of your victor. What's the word I'm looking for? Be humiliated with your face in the dust in humiliation. And that's what it's describing there. But I think somewhere later in the Hebrew language, someone comes across a little reptile that seems to be crawling on his belly and licking the dust of the earth, and they attach that word to that reptile. Say, well, that's a this, based on the knowledge, the memory of the curse of that being in Genesis. So the Hebrew word gets used in that account, but I don't think in that account it means serpent. I think that probably happened later in the history of the language that it got attached to a serpent. So whatever that word meant, it meant this tempter being that the Bible seems to acknowledge as Satan, that Satan took some form that gets this Hebrew word attached to it, and it's not a serpent at all. It's a intelligent humanoid type person who's talking to him. So once you do that, Satan is supernatural in the sense that it's not a part of our natural experience. That then becomes the only supernatural element in the whole account, if I've interpreted it rightly.
Yeah, Jack, what's your thoughts on the garden? The way we see it as being a perfect and lush, and then them being excluded from it, or all mankind being excluded, and having to toil in the dust for their livelihood. You know, we think of punishment from God being more something in the future, and that judgment is put off until then, even though, you know, we all maybe might be chastised in the world. But God dealing so dramatically in the account.
Yeah, I probably haven't thought about this enough, Richard, but again, just off the cuff, I think we do see God withdrawing some of the blessing that he's been giving them in the garden. He is withdrawing that. But mostly our view of the garden is that it has to go along with perfection, right? Mm-hmm. Because God created this perfect world that then fell from perfection. And so we make that garden probably a lot more perfect than it actually was. I think it was God's provision, God's abundance, God's blessing on Adam and Eve in this temporary phase in the initial stage of human existence where he provided for them quite abundantly. And he's going to withdraw that after their disobedience. So I do think you have a relative fall from abundance after the garden. But I don't think that's the fall from perfection to imperfection. That's just in the history and in the story. God is saying, okay, you're going to have to work. I'm not going to just make it easy on you any longer.
And then also his relationship seems to change with mankind.
God's relationship to mankind.
Walking with him
right.
in the garden.
Right, that's right. And mostly from their end. So, you know, God comes to meet them in the garden after their disobedience, and they feel their nakedness and want to cover their nakedness. And I think that's because they are ashamed. They have manifest themselves as these evil creatures, evil in relationship to their creator, ungrateful, proud, rebellious, arrogant. And I think they sense the shame of that. And now we'd have to get into my theory of sexuality, but my theory of sexuality is that there's a mind-body connection in all of us, that we have the sense that to reveal my body is to reveal myself. And so we also have a corresponding sense to hide my body is to hide myself from others. So why did they feel the need to cover up? Because when they felt their shame, they wanted to cover their shame and not have that exposed to God. And I just think there's something in our heads that we think that when we can cover up our bodies, we've covered up who we are. Who we are is actually invisible, but I just think we're hardwired to make that connection. That's why the biblical sexual ethics is what it is. You don't just go giving your body to anybody. Mm-hmm. Because to give your body is to give yourself. To give your body is to promise yourself. And that's why the biblical sexual ethics is you give your body to the one that you are giving yourself, that you've pledged to give yourself to for the rest of your lives. If you give it to somebody else, you're lying. That is a treacherous lie, to give sexual knowledge of your body to another human being that you are not going to follow through with giving your life to them.
I mean, then along that line, further in the account where God provides animal skins, mm-hmm. possibly you think that's beginning of the sacrificial system, or do you see that way?
I don't think so. Mm-hmm. I don't think you get the sacrificial system until you get to the next generation. I think Cain killed Abel, right? I think, who offered first? Cain, right? Didn't Cain offer first? He's the one that offered vegetables?
Yes.
Yeah, and then Cain killed Abel. Cain invented the sacrificial system, is my reading of it. Okay.
So the animal skins and all that, that was just...
It just, God had a superior fashion sense to...
Yeah.
I mean, fig leaves
couldn't
really...
Get away with it today,
that though. Is so last century.
Okay, thank you.
So Jack, help me out. I'm still trying to miss this verse in Romans 5:18 where it says, consequently, just as the result of one trespass was condemnation for all men. I'm still trying to figure out how that fits for your theory of view.
Okay, that's not Adam's transgression in the way I'm reading it. Yeah, he's just looking at, let's look at your life. Any one of your transgressions makes you worthy of condemnation. You probably got at least a couple, right? So any one of them would make you worthy of condemnation and destruction. So when it comes to forgiveness, he forgives the whole lot of them, every one of your transgressions, all of your sins, all of your evils, all of your manifestations of evil. God's mercy meets all of that and says, never mind, I'm not going to give you what you deserve for that. So that's the abundance of God's mercy. But when it comes to God's condemnation, God would always only give you what your transgressions deserve when it comes to judgment. So it's like, I mean, think about in our court system, you got a serial killer, and he gets sentenced to death 10 times or something like that. I mean, on the one hand, that seems silly, but it's kind of a legal fiction, but it's a meaningful legal fiction, right? Because even if some governor later came along and pardoned you for two of those, you still got eight more on your sentence. So you got to die. You still have to die. They would all have to be pardoned, I assume. Maybe I don't know what I'm talking about, but I would assume that they would all have to be pardoned in order for someone to go on living. Well, that's kind of what we are at the judgment. If we get what we deserve, our punishment will be destruction for multiple times to be served consecutively. You know, God has the right to condemn us for every one of our transgressions. So when instead he shows us mercy, look how unlimited, how boundless, how hilarious and ridiculous is the mercy of God, that he would say, yeah, I know, but I'm going to count all of that irrelevant. I'm just going to give you life because my son wants you in the kingdom with him. I'm going to give you life, and you don't have to pay me for any of that garbage in your life. Pay me back for any of that. Okay, I've kept you a little over. We'll cut it off here. Not sure what we'll do next week. We'll either come back to this or we'll press on. I'll have to think about that, but...